She's a soloist, a chamber musician, and a principal player with one of the world's major orchestras. I'm Susan McGinnis. On this edition of Conversations, we talk with Michelle Zukowski. She is a clarinetist, the principal clarinetist for the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Michelle, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Susan.
Good. I want to talk first about this instrument. My understanding is that it was a folk instrument, a reed pipe that came into the hands of a flute maker sometime around 1700. What did Johann Denner have in mind that created a clarinet?
First there was the flute, and then there was the oboe. I mean, the flute is one of the earliest instruments known to mankind. And then the clarinet, which was almost a modernization of a wind instrument, the clarinet somehow added an extra octave. So it became, you know, you could play lower, much lower than a flute and almost as high as a flute. Much lower, I would say, by an octave. So, which is 8 notes lower, and so we have tremendous flexibility. And it's kind of not a natural instrument. Denner sort of had to figure out in his mind that, how am I going to make this instrument so it's not just the tube, because if I have a tube that wants to go 5 octaves, it would be like monstrously long. So somehow he made it almost as the same length as a flute, yet he added an extra number of notes to it.
And that's why there's 20 holes and almost as many keys?
Mm-hmm. Somehow he figured out with the inside, which is called the bore, with all the little venturis, which is these little twists and turns, he's able to somehow make the instrument add more notes.
Do you think when Denner created this instrument, he created the same sound as the sound you play when you...
No, because I play the early instruments. I would say, from the very first instrument, clarinet, which was like 3 or 4 holes in it, and then you just sort of overblew them. And that sound was much more folksy, as you say, and more plangent and softer sounding. And this is more modern. This is not my instrument, actually, but I'm borrowing Stuart Hudson's instrument. But it's all the same. This should be loud enough to hear in a concert hall, which is away from the folk feeling of everything, and into the concert hall. Two or 3,000 people at one time should be able to hear this instrument without the aid of a microphone.
And what makes that possible?
Just the way somehow they built it with harder wood. When they first made the instrument, it was made out of this very soft boxwood, which didn't project as much, but it had other good things about it. It was more like a voice. But this is more like a machine in a way. I can really, you can really project on it.
Uh-huh. What made it attractive to orchestras? I understand that this is about when Johann Denner was first starting to work with this as an invention, an evolution in his hands. It was about 1700, and by 1740, it was being composed for and was in orchestras. What made it welcomed?
Well, the reason is, first of all, the clarinet could play in many different keys. It's a matter of that the clarinet not only was very flexible and play in different keys. We'd actually have like clarinets for each key. You could get an A, B flat, C, D. Like you could have a stand with all the different clarinets, and you could just play in any key you want. You could almost play in the key of C major, but it'll sound different on each of these varying lengths of instruments. Anyway, so we had a lot of clarinets for each key, and we had lots of flexibility, and it's a very exciting instrument. You can bring out all sorts of moods, whereas the flute and the oboe, even the French horn, have more of one kind of a mood. Uh-huh. Clarinets can play jazz, they can play anything.
Right, and so even in 1700, or that period, a composer looked at that instrument and said, oh my, look what it can do for me.
Yeah, exactly.
I read about, I have to make sure I can remember the piece, oh yes, the clarinet quintet in A major, a work by Mozart, that this is a description in the liner notes, that Mozart was able to create from this instrument a clear articulated voice that could also play contrapuntally, in counterpoint, so it could play against other melodies successfully. Is that voice what allows it to do that?
Yeah, exactly. So what you're saying is that it could be a solo instrument and it accompanies beautifully. That's a simplified way of saying it. So we can go, I'll just play this instrument. I don't know if it's going to play, but
see.
you could sing the melody, and I could go. Or we could go. Part, the second clarinet part can go so nicely. So you have those two things that this clarinet can do, where an oboe player, they don't do such good accompanying in that same kind of sense.
What attracted you to this instrument? I mean, the sound is glorious, and so I wonder if you heard it first or if something else brought you to it.
Well, my father, I come from a family of clarinet players, and my husband's father also, and my husband's a clarinet player. It's like a circus family, sort of. So I'm just sort of the last link in the circus that play. So my father was first clarinet with the Los Angeles Philharmonic for 40 years. He taught me, and I shared the same position with him in the Los Angeles Philharmonic. So I mean, what attracted it was just it seemed almost like evolution. I just sort of picked up the instrument and didn't have to have extensive training because it was in my blood, basically.
Do you believe that? This is almost your genetic instrument? It
Well, it was
matches
in
you?
my ears, let's put it that
Yes.
way.
All
I
right.
won't go into DNA at this time.
This is Michelle Zukowski, our guest today on Conversations. We're talking about the clarinet. I want to just play a short story back to you to see if it's really true. I understand that your dad didn't so much hand you a clarinet as leave them around the house so you could stumble into them. Is that?
Right, like toys.
And was it like a toy?
Well, it was until the third note, and he just said, "You're going to practice, you're going to play, you're going to be the first clarinetist of the all world orchestra." No, just kidding.
Oh,
He was very nice. He was really cool. He just let me do my thing.
So there wasn't
Fabulous.
any pressure to be.
Absolutely not. He just gave me lessons, and even until I was 16, there was no pressure. I only took maybe 7 or 8 years of lessons with him. And then somebody else heard me and pushed me, a violinist, and made me just do chamber music, and I did touring with that a little bit. And then I got the job at the LA Philly when I was really young. I wasn't aware. It's funny how you get all these things when you're not aware and you're not awake, and then suddenly you wake up one day, "Ooh, I'm first clarinetist of the Los Angeles Philharmonic." So that's what happened. It was a very nice way for me to deal with life.
You were just 18 when you were brought onto the Philharmonic. This is so young. Did you ever stop and say, this air is too rarefied for me, or did you just understand that this is where you should be?
I just thought it was fine. I had no
It's fine.
problem with it. Yeah, I loved doing it.
So it didn't feel like rarefied air, it felt like playing the clarinet.
Well, it's not that, I shouldn't say, but it's not that horribly difficult for me. So it just feels natural. I mean, I had to get to this point where I say it feels natural because the learning process is very hard. You wake up at the age of 25 and you say, I don't sound as good as I thought I did. And a lot of child prodigies go through that. And 25 is a funny age. 23, you're making your push in 25, and a lot of people suffer from stage fright. I didn't, but I woke up and I said, "Oh, it's hard." So I went through 6 or 7, maybe 10 years of really practicing a lot, because I didn't practice much until then. And then it became, and I say this now at the age of 50, really easy. But I had to go through all that process to make it easy again for me.
On some level, was your psyche relearning the clarinet with a mature voice?
Yeah, in other words, my psyche was becoming in tune with what it felt like when it was easy for me. But I did have to go through the physical practicing of 2 hours a day or something to get there again.
And do you keep up regular practice now?
Who's listening?
Just two of us.
No, because of, I mean, I'll tell the kids, yes, you should practice a lot, because in a way, if you practice when you're younger, it's like money in the bank, collecting interest,
yeah.
So that maybe then you wouldn't have to, as I did, to go through that relearning process.
Mm-hmm.
So,
is the way your father introduced you to the clarinet the best way all around, as far as you're concerned? I'm thinking again of who's listening, parents and
absolutely
children.
The best way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for the parent, if he or she has a child that might be interested, you can't afford to have five or six clarinets lying around, but you can have a lot of music playing, and you know, you could open the kid up to, you know, the possibilities of music, you know, mm-hmm. introduce him in some way that's gentle, you know.
Uh-huh. The opposite of the stage parent or the...
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah. They weren't. They yeah. went that way.
Yeah. This is another thing that I read. Mozart's clarinetist was Anton Stadler.
Right.
Did I say that right?
Yes, yes, you did.
And he was... Mozart said of Stadler that he played the clarinet like the voice, the closest thing to the voice he had ever heard. And Stadler evidently responded by saying, this is the way music should be learned. You should sing it first, no matter how good or bad your voice is. Music should come through kind of this part of you, lungs and throat and the resonance of the head. I'm just going to kind of toss that to you and see what you think about that.
Well, that's
thought.
Absolutely true, because uh-huh. Gregor Piatigorsky, excuse me, the famous cellist, said, if you don't know how a phrase goes, sing it first, and then it'll come out right. And I agree that, and of course in the early clarinets, as I said earlier, that they were easy, they were kind of in a way easier to sing on. It was just an extension of your body. So here we have to actually kind of learn to make this a little more mechanized instrument, a part of our body.
Once again, this is because of the keys, so there's a little more intellectual.
Yeah, but it's also, there's a resistance there. It's just, the earlier instruments, you just go, mwah, and these, there's a little resistance there that for me now is gone, because I know how to work it. But you see some kids, you know, they play like this, you know, they just build up their own resistance and they go, and then they don't realize that they're
all scrunched up.
Everything is kind of, there's a separation between you and the flow of air that should come through. It shouldn't stop, it should just go through. So it's just, it should come from here, the heart and the stomach or whatever.
While you have this in hand, I closed my eyes today when I was thinking about this instrument, and I thought, okay, what are the sounds I associate? And it's Mozart, and it's Brahms, but it's also Gershwin, and Bulgarian wedding music, mm-hmm. and klezmer mm-hmm. music. And I realized, and you talked about this a little bit, all the different sounds. Have people over time looked at this instrument and said, oh, I can make this do what my heart says, and out comes klezmer music, or out comes Gershwin's music, or is this make sense, that this instrument has inspired all these different voices?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's for the klezmer, as far as the clarinet goes, it's the instrument that is absolutely so part of the Jewish tradition, where you could just pick it up and play it. So with an oboe, you know, you have to get a reed buzzing, you have to make the reed. With the flute, it doesn't quite have that gutsiness. This gives you what the Jewish wedding needs, along with the violin, that funkiness, you know.
Uh-huh.
And with
spirit.
Jazz, you know, it's so easy, spirit. And with the jazz, it's just the natural. It's a chameleon, the chameleon of instruments.
How many kinds of clarinet do you play? I mean, your focus is mostly classical, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you play these other voices as
yeah,
well?
Sort of badly. I can play them.
Can you give us just a couple of sounds from it?
Of jazz?
Yeah, or whatever comes to your mind.
And then this instrument plays good. Let's see if I can do Rhapsody in Blue in this. You can always, well, I don't know. This is not my instrument. And then you can play Mozart. It's fantastic.
I must say, I've never sat this close to Rhapsody in Blue, which is one
did
of my favorite pieces.
Did it hurt your ears?
It didn't hurt my ears, but it came through my body. Do you feel this instrument reverberating through
yes.
you as you play it?
Yes.
Wow. I mean, it truly vibrated through the chair here.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm happy. This is Michelle Zukowski. She is the principal clarinetist for the Los Angeles Philharmonic. She's with us on this edition of Conversations. Let's stay with versatility for a minute. I talked to a trumpet player some years ago who said that his instrument had been, typecast from time to time in its history. There were eras when it couldn't get out of a marching band or couldn't get out of some other kind of influence. Has the clarinet ever fallen into
a typecast,
mm-hmm.
sort of a pigeonhole situation?
Yeah.
Not really. I'll tell you what the problem with the clarinet is that Bach didn't write for it because it didn't exist, Vivaldi. So we don't have any Baroque music. So, I mean, but in a way, even playing Bach works. I mean, anyone can play Bach. Really? I don't know. Let me think of some Bach. I mean, it even works for that. Doesn't sound too original instrument movement style, but so. You know, I can't find anything wrong with the clarinet. It's crazy.
No matter what.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I read in an interview that you play as many different ways and forms as you do to keep yourself stimulated. I think the question was about how can you manage a solo career and a chamber music career and a first chair career. What do all those things do for you as a musician?
Well, I can't just do one thing. It's just, if I were just to do what most of the other people in our orchestra do, is just play orchestra repertoire, I would get really kind of burnt out very quickly. Get burnt out with the people around me, with the repertoire, which is limited, and conductors, which are also, for me, interesting, but I mean, fine, but you know, for me, I like to do some stuff on my own just to keep everything going. So if I have a little chamber music going, you know, and if they let me out for doing this, I'm very grateful. I take off during the months that the orchestra's not working or whatever. Then everything is alive for me. I can't handle it when that burnt out. And the C word that a lot of orchestra musicians suffer from, which is cynical, that cynical problem, cynicism. I don't want any part of that, so I just want to do everything.
Where do you think that cynicism comes from? Besides playing one thing in one place?
No, it's usually because they're burnt out a little bit, and they're unhappy just doing the same thing over and over, and they don't know it. And they get to the point where they just say, well, all right, I'll go out, like, big deal, I'll go do something. They get that funny little attitude, and that's the attitude one tries to stay away from, to keep alive.
What's a hazard in your career, then?
Terrible.
Did you get to the point where you sorted that out, or did you always know that you had to keep many things in the air for yourself?
Well, I just kind of a person where I love to travel, so I just like that combination. It was just perfect. Of course, I have to make sure that I don't stay away too long. You know, I have a family. I mean, I have my husband and my parents and relatives. So if I stay away too long, after 2 weeks, it's sort of like, Hi. After 3 weeks, it's
oh no.
Hi.
Where have you been?
So I've got a, you know, 10 days is a good number.
There's a tether at home.
Yeah. Well, also I don't even want to stay away that long. Uh-huh. Just every once in a while, just to charge my batteries.
I have another question about different kinds of music. Recently, Itzhak Perlman and Oscar Peterson, who's a jazz pianist, put out a new album together. I think it's called Side by Side, and it's all standards. Stormy Weather, Making Whoopee. And Itzhak Perlman said, when asked about the classical musician playing jazz, he said, well, it's all music, but I had to tune my ear differently to understand the melody of it. And then he said, now let me think if I can remember this part. I have to tune my ear differently to hear the melody of it. Oh, and once I was playing it right, it didn't sound like Itzhak Perlman anymore.
And really? That's amazing.
Yeah, he said when he played it back, he didn't hear himself playing the fiddle, he heard jazz.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Tell me why that's wonderful. I thought it was fascinating, but I don't see it from a musician's point of view.
Well, what he's saying is, you know, have you ever noticed when you walk around this earth and you're just living and you find yourself getting into these ruts? I mean, you'll find yourself thinking about something and then you think about the same thing over and over and over.
Yes.
And the older you get, your mind gets even more into these little ruts. So sometimes when you're playing, that also can happen. So you have this way that you're going to shift, this way you're going to play, and it's going to sound like Itzhak Perlman. So this, what the jazz did for Perlman is it got him out of that little rut, and it's just like cleared his brain, and he could form new little rivulets. That, number one, and number two, you know, he was into another complete art form, which is wonderful too, which stimulated it.
Certainly, which is why Oscar Peterson said, I'm remembering more of the interview now, that playing with Itzhak, Peterson had to anticipate differently because his habits were focused on those jazz rhythms, it seems to me. And with Itzhak, he had to listen to a different musician playing, a different whole universe of music
right.
being played.
Well, I'd love to hear that album. Yeah. Just to hear Itzhak not sound like Itzhak, and Peterson not rushing.
Well, we'll listen for it. I suppose that was a little promotion. It's Side by Side, if you missed it the first time, and it's Itzhak Perlman and Oscar Peterson. Today on Conversations, we're talking with clarinetist Michelle Zukofsky. She teaches at the University of Southern California, in addition to her solo career and chamber work and work with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. She joined the Philharmonic when she was 18. You mentioned that this is not your instrument, but it's also not the kind of instrument you play. Tell me the differences between clarinets in that way. I don't understand.
Well, I play a German clarinet. Because most of my repertoire is German, so I just happened to pick it because I like the sound of it and changed over. I even changed my fingering system to play it. This is a French buffet, which is what everybody in America plays, except me, actually. So it's very accessible, and you can just pick it up and play it. But with a German clarinet, for me, it sounds very good on Beethoven and Brahms, and it has a special quality that I like for orchestra repertoire, which is how I make my money. And it always sounds, to me, very good. This is a specialized sound. The fingering is different a little bit, and the mouthpiece is different. This is the mouthpiece.
Mm-hmm.
The reed is different. But actually, playing this, it seems very, very similar to the way I play this particular French instrument. It's just a little subtle nuance that not too many people can hear. Conductors don't even know the difference. It's just other clarinet players. It's just a matter of taste why you pick this outfit over another outfit, basically.
Right. And this is also one of the subtleties of your universe. mm-hmm. as differentiated from somebody else's who's not a clarinet player. You would notice this, feel
right.
this. And,
sure.
Yeah. Why did French clarinets come to America and German clarinets not?
French clarinets came to America because in 1930, around then, they needed first clarinetists and first oboes and first flutists and all the major orchestras. So the Philadelphia Orchestra brought people from France. Tabby Toe, from, who was an oboe player, Daniel Benoit, who was a clarinet player, and it was a whole bunch of French people, and they influenced America, and that's the reason.
It's almost always something like that,
isn't
it?
It's a real simple answer.
Right. Who was on hand at the time. And
exactly.
That's right. Let me tell you a bit more about Michelle Zukowski. She studied with her father, who is Kalman Bach. He's now retired.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was the principal clarinetist with the Los Angeles Philharmonic and passed it on to her when she became 18 years old. Not that it was his to pass, but that this woman was clearly the next in line for that chair as principal clarinetist. She's also, as we've mentioned, a noted chamber musician and soloist performing in recitals. Among her music festival appearances, the Sitka Music Festival. We know about that one very well here. Also the Spoleto and the Ravinia, the mostly Mozart Festival, the Marlborough, and Casals Festivals. And she plays also with the Lincoln Center Chamber Players. Most recently, a tour to Australia and South America was done with Pinchas Zukerman. Michelle Zukowski and not her clarinet, but her clarinet, is with us on this edition of Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. I want to ask you questions about being a woman and a principal clarinetist. And I kind of don't know whether this line of questioning even is logical, so you'll have to just kind of dash it aside if it isn't. But is a piano and is a violin and is a flute still a woman's instrument? And is a clarinet not? Or is a clarinet anyone's instrument?
No, it's mostly, I mean, until 25 years ago, there were no women in major orchestras playing clarinet. In fact, I would say that I'm among the first, I think, maybe I am the first woman, now that I think of it. And so...
Who's a principal?
Yeah. Because, I mean, pianists, like in Mozart's time, you know, he taught all these ladies, and Vivaldi, God knows, taught all the ladies. And that's part of their dowry. I mean, they didn't have record players, so the women played the piano. And they could play the flute. That was a little more accepted, and then the harp and all those instruments. But then the clarinet and even the oboe and the French horn, trumpet, boy, those are latecomers. And then you start the professional orchestra where men are competing with women for jobs. The tendency would be to hire a man because he's the breadwinner of the family. I mean, it's as simple as that. So you'll have more men, and if there's a woman trying out and a man trying out, and I'm not saying what's right or wrong, because I just don't understand too many things about that. The man will get the job.
Have you ever found any stumbling blocks in your career for
that? No, but
reason?
I've seen it.
Seen it.
In fact, sometimes I would venture to say that a lot of times other women keep women out because they don't want, you know, all women, you know, sometimes. So they'll just say, let's get a 50-50, 50% men, 50% women. Huh. Or when I first joined the orchestra, it was like six women and the rest were men.
In the whole orchestra?
Uh-huh.
How big was the orchestra?
110. Yeah. I had a good time, I got to tell you. God, so many dates.
Yeah.
So little time.
But it was a man's world.
It still is, in a way.
Huh. Do you... Now, how do I ask you this? Because it's about the water you swim in, the air you breathe. But do you feel that you accommodate yourself to this different, more masculine atmosphere?
It depends on the woman. I learned, or I must just... because of my background of being around a lot of men, I have no problem, because I just liked being around men, mm-hmm. as I like being around women too. Right. I don't have a problem with either. So I just don't, maybe there are other men and women like me that just, there's no problem. I don't see a sure. difference.
So you didn't
I'm just flexible.
You didn't walk into a man's environment. You walked into a room with a lot of men in it and got to know them.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Is that good advice?
Yeah, I think if you're a woman, you should enjoy being a woman yeah. and enjoy the men. And if you treat the men like men, they love it too. It's, it just doesn't seem to be a big problem for me. I'm sorry to say.
No, I mean, you heard it here. That's yeah. That sounds like good advice.
Yeah, I mean, enjoy the even the effect you have on men, but don't use it. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, it's men, as soon as they see that you enjoy being a woman and you accept that they're a man and you deal with them in that way, it's, I've never had a problem.
Mm-hmm. And as a musician, that's true too. Mm-hmm. Not just as a, it's not a gender thing, but a musical
yeah,
thing
I'm
as
not
well.
Count, but then there are problems, you know, with, you know, in the work field, they really, you do have to, and this is the little catch, that they will go for the men first because there's prejudice, and this I accept. Mm-hmm. I don't like it, and we're going to change it. I'm one of the first people, I think, in the orchestral world that has changed it. I just feel comfortable with the fact that there is prejudice, and just we'll get there somehow where it's not going to be anymore.
Mm-hmm. One by one.
Yeah.
What would you tell a young girl who's really attracted to the clarinet?
Practice.
Play that thing. Go
oh,
far.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And don't take no for an answer? Or?
You mean don't take no as far as what? In other words, when they turn you down, well, try for another job.
Right. Be persistent.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, my best students are women. So what am I going to say? Don't play the clarinet because you're a woman? You can't.
This is a related question, a differently related question. As the economy goes through its twists and turns, music and other like arts tend to be seen as luxuries in schools. What's your, as someone who teaches as well as plays, what's your sense of the culture seeing music curriculum as a luxury from grammar school to colleges to universities?
I think it's terrible that it's become a luxury, because for the Germans, the Europeans, it's bread and water, and here it's a luxury. I mean, music is one of the beginnings of mankind. Man started with music, and to get rid of any of that in the schools is an absolute sin. I think it's horrendous that it's being taken, considered a luxury.
When you say humans started with music, is that something about the development of soul and intellect, or am I?
Well, music was a way of calling somebody over on the next mountain. And it was the entertainment after you've done your hunting for the day. Mm-hmm. So that was just the same time they started doing those paintings on the cave. So it's really human nature.
Elemental.
Huh. It's too bad in the schools that they need football. I mean, I don't watch it, but I'm sure it's really a good thing. And and they need these sports. This is wonderful too. They shouldn't get rid of any of it. Mm-hmm. No, they need sports. They need. I mean, people say, well, we'll have to cut back on this. Well, maybe they should cut back on something else, or just, you know, work the their fiscal policy in another way, but there should. When I was a kid, we had an orchestra, we had a music teacher that would come see us once a week. Now I teach at USC, and I'm teaching kids that can play the clarinet but have never heard a symphony and never played in an orchestra. Hmm. So my job as a teacher is really hard. We have 4 clarinet teachers at USC, and we're working overtime to try to get these kids so they have some kind of an education that 50 years ago would have been no problem.
Because again, they would have swum in that sea of sound.
They would have had their little music teacher coming in once a week, tutoring, and they would have been playing. And of course, a lot of the problems is television and radio. You just turn on your music. Mm-hmm. So why should we learn instruments? You can just plug it into the synthesizer even. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of composers that don't even know how to write music. You just plug it in and just say, I'll have a little Bach. And that's the way it is.
Right, throw on the drums.
Mm-hmm, right. Throw on the drums.
This is Michelle Zukowski. She does record for Decca London, Nonesuch, and Avant Records. Do you, if people would like to find your playing on disc, other than label, what should they look for? Tell me.
Well, I didn't record for about 10 years, but and I'm starting to again. Let's see. I don't know. See, I didn't make any CDs, so all mine are just albums, analog. But I'm starting again with Koch International. I'm making an all Martin New record, and I'm just going to start recording again.
Good. So yeah. We should look for discs sometime in the next year or so.
Yeah, in the next thereafter. Couple of years. Yeah, I'll start recording
all
again.
Right. For to add to your collection, Michelle Zukowski, coming up on Koch. This is Conversations, and I'm Susan McGinnis. Can I ask you about reeds?
Sure.
You said something to our friend Robert Hannon about reeds are no problem if you've got enough money because you could just keep throwing them away.
Yeah, that's what I do. I have a wastebasket sort of at the end of the room, and it's hard to throw them because they're like long bits of wood. You know, you got to get your aim just right. It's really good. I can just get it right in there. But they're made of
hand coordination.
Yeah, I know. But this is a reed, in case anyone wants to know what a reed is. Right. The bane of our existence. It's bamboo, basically.
Thin at one end, a little thicker at the other.
Oh, we're not on TV.
No, we're just
okay.
On radio.
All right.
We'll talk about it.
Okay, we'll talk about this arundo. It's called bamboo, and it's arundo donax. That's the. That's just bamboo but it's a form of bamboo, and you just file it down and you make it into a reed, and it's grown in southern France, and you get 1 out of 10 in a box that maybe works.
No.
Yeah.
Well. But yeah. This instrument has been around on reeds since 1700.
I know,
and you're still dealing with 1 out of 10 in a box that works?
If we're lucky, yeah. And the box costs $10, $15. So what I do, my answer is I just buy I buy clothes on consignment and live in a cheap house, basically.
Buy a lot of reeds.
I buy a lot, and my husband who plays buys millions of them too. Huh. I can make them, but I haven't found any good cane lately. So I've been just buying them, having kind of a nicer life. Because then you just open up the box, you try them, and put them on the clarinet. And if they work, they work. If they don't, you throw.
For a non-clarinetist, of which there are many in the audience, what makes a reed work or not work? What's the problem?
Well, first of all, what a reed does when you put it on the mouthpiece, the top part of the instrument, is it has to vibrate. It has to buzz. And if it doesn't buzz, it won't play. And some reeds, each reed is as different as a snowflake. You never have the same reed twice because it's from nature. So some reeds don't vibrate. They're really hard. They're like rock. And others are really soft like paper. So you have to find the right one with the right tone quality and the right articulation, which is separating of the notes and all. So it has to do a lot of things. Poor reed. And sometimes they don't last very long. I mean, I know some people have had them for like, mine only lasts like a week or two. And then I gotta open more boxes.
And that says how much you play, or just the...
Might have something to do. Some people make, no, I think it's just the way the cane's being grown. I know in 1940, when during World War II, they were showing the troops, you know, helping out in France, you know, and you see them going through the burning the cane fields, and you see the clarinet players, you know, these were in the army, they'd be crying, oh my God, there goes our crop, you know. And so, of course, as a result of World War II, we're suffering. It's like, you know, we don't have as, and we have to artificially age them to get them moving again. It's like wine, fine wine. If a good year of wine, 1985, it's a good year of cane, too, and because it's all grown in the same area, southern France.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So you laugh, but you're very nearly serious when you say that in the 40s there was, clarinetists mourned the loss of their crop.
Oh, you'd see bassoonists almost just cry, oh my God, they're things, I don't care if we're winning, look what's happening.
Save the crop.
Really. Huh.
Fascinating.
And then now you see a lot of the crops of cane being turned into furniture, you know, and I'm looking, you know, in France and looking at all that cane furniture and feel like, rip those chairs apart and make me a reed.
Get your priorities straight.
Yeah.
This is a reed problem.
Yeah, it is.
Well, now, is it something about the organic structure of bamboo that makes it, if imperfect, the perfect reed? It's not something you can synthesize, or
we've tried. Uh-huh. There are jazz players that play the plastic ones, you know, but it doesn't quite have a good classical sound. It sounds a little blatty, you know. Uh-huh. So it has to have a nice sound too. Uh-huh. Some reeds have really awful sounds. You know, you could just crack glass with them.
Amazing. But this instrument is
a buffet.
Ebony.
It's grenadilla. Yeah.
Grenadilla.
It's brown, actually. You see clarinets, they're black, but they're dyed black. Uh-huh. They're not born black. So that's what
and
happens.
And it's the color that makes one think it's always been ebony.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. In fact, Stravinsky wrote the Ebony Concerto, which is a misnomer. It should have been the Grenadilla Concerto.
It probably didn't sound quite so classy as the
right.
Ebony Concerto.
Right.
Some, I understand, are made of plastic.
Mm-hmm, and rubber. I started out on a rubber clarinet. And since the bore is the same, you can sort of get the same sound. It doesn't vibrate as the same way.
And is it much like your Wurlitzer, as opposed to the French, that it's a matter of taste for the player?
Mm-hmm.
I like the plastic or the rubber or the granadilla.
No,
or
wood is just
wood
better.
Is better, okay.
In fact, anything organic is better on these instruments. Even these metal keys would be better maybe if they were wood. Who knows? Huh. No. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, the less anything plastic on the instrument takes away something from it. But, you know, you can't think about all that when you play. You just have to play
right.
At a certain point.
Is it a harder, less resonant sound? Because
plastic?
The vibration, yes, because the vibration is
it
different.
Doesn't vibrate.
It doesn't vibrate.
Vibrate in an organic way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't, there's no law of physics applied to plastic as there is with wood.
You have had works composed for you.
Mm-hmm.
John Williams composed one that you presented in Tanglewood in 1991. I assume it's a great compliment when someone composes for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an acknowledgement of the greatness of your playing. Is it also, harking back to our thoughts about Itzhak Perlman and Oscar Peterson, is John Williams also responding to something in the way you play when he says, this is a woman I want to compose for?
Well, actually, I got to be honest with you. I asked him to write me a piece.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah.
And say, John, come on, you can do it. You can write something classical.
Well, are you then, I'll turn that around, are you then responding to something in him?
Yeah, he's a very sensitive musician. I think a wonderful, underrated conductor, actually. So I just responded to, like, a couple of his pieces. One of them called The Reavers, and it just was written so nicely for the instrument. I thought, gee, well, I want a concerto by somebody who's everybody knows about, not just esoterica that's in the school, even though that can also be pretty good too. Mm-hmm. So I wanted a popular composer of the day. I have, when I get back, Leonard Rosenman, who's another studio composer, is writing me a piece. And and if I have that time, I'll learn them, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the really esoteric modern things, it's hard for me to have the time to learn them. The clarinetist up here, Ted DiCorso, is wonderful for the contemporary music. He has a little more time in a way than I have, I think. Maybe he doesn't, but he really specializes in the very, in fact, he's at Banff now, playing just contemporary music. Took a sabbatical just to learn all the ways to do it, all the little special tricks.
Talk to me about that, the time and esoterica. What is it that...
Well, that's a long story. A lot of contemporary and a lot of music found its way as a result of Pierre Lunaire, I think, Schoenberg, started writing music that didn't have mass appeal. You know, he wrote in a 12-tone style, which was, you know, it didn't give you your basic happy chords, sad chords, you know. Mm-hmm. It was more a little, this tone sort of leads to this tone, but it didn't give you feelings, like normal feelings. They were just angst and worried and weird, which I liked, but
yeah.
This 12-tone music, unfortunately, went a little further and further away from the mainstream, and so people, the audiences, after around the 40s and 50s, got much more esoteric. And whereas in Mozart's time, you know, you could sing the melodies, and with Rossini, everybody in the town knew what was the last night's opera. They certainly didn't know Schoenberg's Moses and Aaron, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm here to tell you that. And so as a result, all this music sort of ended up in the university because not too many people want to hear it. So there's people in the university writing a lot of music that nobody knows about or even cares to hear. And this is sort of, I mean, not too many people agree with me, but I really feel that music's gone way too off on one tangent of just, let's look at the score. Doesn't it look fantastic? That's called Augen music, because he just looks good, but it doesn't necessarily sound or feel good.
Your playing is more from the spirit than from the intellect, from your point of view.
No, I like the intellectual, in a way, music too. I just want it to have some connection the 10th time you hear it, and you don't have to, I mean, it doesn't have to have immediate impact, but, you know, it's got to have some interest and some feelings and emotion and not just this intellectual puzzles.
Who's composing the best for emotions these days, or the human?
Well, Carigliano wrote a great clarinet concerto. And I'm not just going to say the studio composers. There are a few. Ligeti's a great composer, Ludoslavsky. These people never went to the universities. And so they really, they know how to write for an audience, a big audience.
And so they're composing for the orchestra to be heard.
They're composing.
Rather than the right. instrument.
They're composing for the people, uh-huh. you know. Uh-huh.
Can we hear a little bit of the John Williams piece? Is that possible? Can I ask you to?
You know, I'll tell you.
Take a part out of a piece?
I can't do that because I didn't memorize it and it doesn't have a particular tune to it. You know, it's just this wave of sound. So if I were to play it, it wouldn't do it justice.
I understand. What I'm thinking of, this is very selfish of me, wanting to hear a bit more of this instrument before we leave this hour with you. I'll resort to another request. Mm-hmm. Any of the composers who you think of as composing for the people? that?
Well, Luda Slusky wrote this six. I'm not playing on my clarinet, but I'll try, if I get the wrong notes, oh well. This is six, one of the six dance preludes, and I gotta rack my mind now which one I wanna do. That's, you know, it's kind of a dance thing.
Dance.
Sure. And then he has a slow melody go. This was written just a few years ago. That's not the piece, but I'm kind of jazzing it up. But it's just that kind of, you know, sort of soul, it's sort of folk background.
Yeah. Yeah, you can definitely feel it reaching out. I'm not quite sure how to say what else that means to me, but it's something that reaches. Yeah. You played it in a recital here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. In that recital, you played a quartet, an all-clarinet quartet. I was sitting in the audience watching you and the other three members and thinking, this must feel like coming home. All clarinet piece. I'm not quite sure what that means, but is that, does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Sure. It, in my family, I mean, I just come from a family of all clarinet players, so it's you know, it's such a little tiny part of some of this life that there's somebody that just is interested in lots of clarinets and comes from a clarinet family, but here it's my complete life in a way. My father played, and my husband plays fabulous clarinet. And clarinetist, he plays at the early clarinets, and his father taught him. He was in the Chicago, so you know. I mean, this represents playing that quartet. It's like my family playing.
Sure. Do you play in quartets with your family? I mean.
Not anymore.
Right.
My father kind of gave up playing, and my father-in-law died. But mm-hmm. In fact, when I think about it, our family, my husband's family and my family, we never actually played because they were, when I met my husband, his father sort of had already retired.
Uh-huh.
But it's a whole meeting of clarinet players.
So you're passing it on by duet in this case.
Exactly.
Yes. Right. Another way of asking about this thought of coming home, less genetically familial, but with four or five, in the case of quintets, instruments, same instruments playing different aspects of the piece. It felt to me when I was watching last night that must be, I don't know, differently delightful.
Yeah, oh, it's wonderful, because you had the music of what we played last night, which was the Brahms Haydn variations. It was transcription of Haydn's St. Anthony Chorale, and he transcribed that for the orchestra, and then we transcribed that, so it was already, you know, second or third generation. But it was, you heard it with all clarinets, and beautifully orchestrated. It's wonderful. Yeah, it did feel like coming home. Yeah.
Have you ever moved from chair to chair, so you're playing different parts of the...
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Musical chairs. Okay, you play second. Okay, you play third. Okay.
That's yeah. Very nice. People who don't know this piece probably wouldn't get this part, except for in the quartet, everyone plays a different part. There's melody, and there's a lead, and there's mm-hmm. there's kind of a rhythmic part. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it goes around. Sometimes the fourth clarinet player has a solo, sometimes, and I'm accompanying, and the third. And so then when I was told when I was coming up here that there's a good clarinet teacher and a good group of clarinet players, so I wanted to use them. And I was really happy with the result.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Exciting. Michelle Zukovsky's with us on this edition of Conversation. She is guest of the Arctic Chamber Orchestra, with whom she went on tour in September of 1994, and also performed, as we've mentioned, in recital in September of 1994. What's coming up for you in this coming year? I'm thinking about a person with several different careers operating. What are you looking forward to?
Let's see. This has been the end. This has been the end of all my festivals, which started in June. So, see, I was in Arizona, and then Alaska, and then I played in New York, and then I taught in Canada, and then I toured Europe after finishing a tour of Taipei. So I'm just going, oh, I can't wait to not play. But actually, coming up, I have to play the Beethoven Septet when I get home, and then I'm going to tour to New York later on in the year, playing the Schubert Octet, you know, with the Chamber Music at the Y, one of those concerts there. And, and you know, it's funny, I have a manager, I don't even know what I'm doing next. It's really crazy.
Does she call and say,
okay, we got this? And in fact, she called me while I was here. Can you play, where else was I supposed to play? I don't remember, but it was a lot of places, and I'm going to turn quite a few down. Right. Alaska, I think I'll always take, because that's my favorite place to play. I don't know, somehow I'm not as nervous here. I'm a nervous person. I mean, I don't act that nervous, but underneath I'm nervous. And here it sort of dissolves my nervousness and tension, because I can just be whoever I feel like being, and people accept me.
Good. Those of us who live here think of it as a well-kept secret, but as long as you promise not to tell.
Oh, we could use a few more people, not too many,
right.
up here.
That's right. Well, I want to thank you so much. It's been a very interesting hour.
Thank you too, Susan.
Yeah. Come back again, play some more.
Okay, I will.
Good. All right.
Thank you.
It'll be lovely. I'm Susan McGinnis. With us today on this edition of Conversations, Michelle Zukofsky. You can go to Los Angeles and buy a ticket and hear her with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, where she is the principal clarinetist, or if you're lucky, you can catch her on tour somewhere in the world. And if you're very lucky, she will return to Fairbanks. Thanks for joining me on this edition of Conversations. I hope you tune in again next week. Thanks a lot. It was fun.